Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Donald Currie, who has a new one-man show, Sex and Mayhem, now appearing at the New Conservatory Theater. It opens tonight and runs through October 10th. New Conservatory Theater is located at Van Ness and Market. Donald Currie, you were out of the theater for 20 years, and then you began working on a CD about your life. What brought you to do that?
Actually, I was out of the theater for almost 30 years, 25 to 30 years. When the AIDS crisis began, I sort of left the theater to start the AIDS Foundation with Cleve Jones and some other people, which led me into studying Chinese medicine, which turned me into an acupuncturist, which I have been doing for the last almost 20 years. I had assumed at that point that theater was something in my past. Theater was something I'd done since I was a little tiny child. But once I dropped out, I figured that was the end of that. And one morning, this is literally true, one morning out of a deep sleep, the opening line of what turned into Sex and Mayhem came out of a dream. And I thought after that line just popped into my head, well, that's a good line. And not only is it funny, but it's true. And I sat down at the computer, and it was as if a 25-year dam had broken. And the rest was almost automatic writing, and it became the script.
For the CD?
For the CD, which is a four-part series of spoken word audiobook CDs. The generation of those has a sort of an interesting tale because that was never meant to happen in the first place.
So what happened?
I began writing the thing, and it just was being almost written by itself. And one of my patients, one of my acupuncture patients, was a guy who came out of the Exploratorium and is a brilliant technological character, and I mean character. And I mentioned, his name is Jason Korski, and I mentioned to him that I was working on this piece. And I had intended the piece to be a live theater production, just because that's what I knew. And Jason said, well, I just bought all this new cool material. Why don't we just play around with it just to have some fun? And I said, great. And one thing led to the next, and that turned into CD number one. Then the text for CD number two got written, and by now Jason and I were like Siamese twins, and we put out CD number two. Jason did all of the electronics. He created all the sound effects, soundtrack, whatnot, and we together created these things that we called movies made out of sound, so that they were produced like movies that you listen to instead of watch, and that's how that came about.
Have you worked on the third CD yet?
The third CD is entirely written, and all of my vocals are done. And I was hoping to have number three out by the time the show opened in September, but I'm sorry, it couldn't happen. Because the text of the live show ends at the end of the second CD. The first CD is an hour long, the second CD is about 75 minutes long. The live show is about 80 minutes long, so we compressed one and two.
How long is the third?
The third is another 75 minutes. And number four is a little more than half written and will probably be another 75 minutes.
The first talks about your growing up and takes you up to going off to Idaho, I think.
Mm-hmm.
We do.
Yeah. We go to Idaho, and it's on the return trip, at the end of the trip to Idaho, that number one ends.
And number two takes us to when your mentor is carted away insane from a crazed party. You state that the 60s were over. What year did that happen?
1969. So the part two goes from about 1965 to 1969.
And the third part will go?
The third part goes up until the end of the 70s. The third part is the 70s. And number four is the 80s into the 90s, and with a sort of an epilogue that takes us up to the present time.
So part three is about the crazed 70s in San Francisco, and part four is about AIDS, basically.
Yeah, pretty much. And then the relationships that occur in the context of those historic periods.
When you were writing this, were you conscious of characters or who would show up or anything like that, or was it so subconscious that that wasn't even part of the makeup?
No, I was aware of characters and who would show up because the essential outline of all four parts is laid out in the opening line of the first script. And so then the rest of it is sort of an explication in history of those five relationships. I was very conscious the whole time of crafting it in a way that was theatrically appropriate so that it would build to climaxes and then be broken by humor and whatnot.
Well, let's take this further. Okay, the CD comes out and gets some nice reviews. Portions of it were played on KPFA by Susan Stone.
Right.
It gets played all over the country. It won a couple of awards. How did that turn into a theater piece? Did someone approach you?
Actually, the way it happened was the Chronicle, Dave Ford from the Chronicle did a rather good piece about the whole project that came out on the Friday of Gay Pride, I think about 2 years ago. The morning that that came out, I called Ed Decker, who's the artistic director of New Conservatory Theater, and said, have you seen today's paper? And Ed said, I just finished reading the article. Why don't you come in and we'll talk? And that was 2 years. I mean, it was just one of those wonderful serendipitous moments. I didn't know Ed Decker. It was nothing. I just was being, you know, brazen and self-promoting. And it was just lovely timing. So I went in and talked. And it took us actually 2 years to actually write the contracts and put the show together. And then he put me together with a director, John Dixon from ACT. I found the composer, Don Seaver, whose whole history has been creating music for the theater. It's been a dream collaboration. Lighting guy Anthony Powers came through John Dixon. John Dixon and Anthony Powers have worked on 5 shows together, and they're like Bobbsey twins. They just know, they finish each other's sentences. And again, the Anthony Powers part of it was a dream collaboration.
So when you're walking into a theater with your own music guy, which helps,
yeah,
but you're kind of getting this director and this lighting guy, but it's your piece from beginning to end. You wrote it. You did voice direction of it, of course, and you performed it,
mm-hmm,
and you performed some of it live already.
Mm-hmm.
When the director comes in and says, uh-uh, that doesn't work, what do you do?
He never did. That's what's been beautiful about working with John, is that he's so good at working with actors that he can get me to do things that I hadn't thought about or hadn't even planned on doing, and I do it. He's brilliant. He has essentially married truth to style, because where I was going with the piece was into higher and higher elevations of the style, which is still there. But John has been able to work with me and say, just tell me those lines. Okay, now put the style back in. So there's never been a moment with John where I felt that I had to hold my fists and clamp down and say, no. It's been like a dream. It's been a dream.
Really?
I keep pinching myself. It's been unbelievable.
How did it feel the first time, last week, when you went in front of an audience?
I think I've never been as happy in my life. When the first night, which was our first preview on a Friday night, ended, and I came home, I just thought, this is the happiest night of my life. This was something that I assumed would never happen to me again. It's like falling in love again. It's like, I'll never fall in love again. And I fell in love again.
Well, Donald Curry, let's talk about the content, because it is about your life. You were born in San Francisco.
Right.
At some point when you were young, you realized you were gay. But this was before, way before, this was in the 50s. This
50s.
Was before,
right,
gay liberation,
right,
before hippies, before everything.
Everything, yeah.
How closeted, how secretive was gay life when you were like 16, 17?
Terribly. It was there, and you could find it if you could sniff around, and I did. And there were some terribly brave people. We all know about those people. But they were, you know, regularly hauled off to prison, and it was tough. It was rough. And especially for a scared young kid, the idea that if I were to get brazen enough to go into some gay place, that I might then be taken away by the police and be in the paper the next day was to say it was impossible and unthinkable. And now, to a lot of young kids who are coming out and just come out, that idea is unthinkable. But nonetheless, that's what the historical time was like.
So you hid?
Totally.
Did your parents have any inkling?
I'm sure they did. I mean, walking into the living room pretending to be Marilyn Monroe would probably gave them some idea.
At what point did you realize that this was something that was real?
The latter part of high school, when I finally realized this is what was happening to me. I did not know what was happening to me. When I was in 13, 14, 15 years old, I could fantasize about men, you know, sexually for hours on end and still not assume that I was gay. I mean, it was just so compartmentalized. And then one day I finally realized, okay, this is what's going on.
And what year was that?
1962.
So it was several years before Stonewall or
Jesus,
years before
yes.
any of that.
The idea that, you know, what happened after Stonewall could ever possibly happen was unthinkable. It was unimaginable.
You became a theater major in college.
Yeah.
And at that point, I would guess that there were other theater majors around as well, beside your teacher.
Yeah.
So it became a little bit easier as long as you maintained that little world.
Yeah, but even in that world, we were all closeted, and it was all, you know, hidden signs, like how gangs do with their gestures and whatnot. It was that way.
Really?
Even in the drama department, yeah. I mean, so many of the drama professors were bonking, you know, their favorite student and whatnot, and it was all completely under the table, and no one spoke of it, and it was just terribly repressed. Even in the drama department, even in San Francisco.
At that point, had San Francisco begun to change at all, do you think?
Well, the beatnik thing was occurring in a very big way. I used to run across to North Beach and have sandals in my backpack and look at it all over there. And that was the beginning of a real sea change of a lot of things, and you could feel it in this town as well, that the beatnik thing was starting to break shatter some barriers.
In those days, did you ever head up to the clubs, Hungry Eye and all of those, to see
yeah.
the performers?
Not Hungry Eye, but we used to go to Savoy Tivoli, and there was a gay bar up on Grant called the Capri, and you know, there were some places that you'd kind of sneak into and look around in.
So you didn't go to the old folk or comedy clubs of those
Did
days?
Did not. No. Oh, I might have one or two times, but it's not something that's really stuck in my memory. I don't remember ever seeing, you know, Mort Saul at the Hungry Eye or Barbara Streisand or something like that. No.
At that point, where was the gay scene? Was it all in North Beach?
It was in North Beach. It was on Polk Street. And it was on South of Market. The Phoebe's and the Stud. The Stud, which, you know, is now remembered as this big flamboyant hippie gay bar, was a very dark leather bar when I first found it. My father owned a warehouse on 8th and Howard, right around the corner from Phoebe's and the Stud and stuff. And during my lunch hour, I'd kind of go sniffing around down there and see, well, these are gay bars, you know. But everything closed down at night south of Market, and boom, there was this dark nightlife down there. So there were areas. There was nothing in the Castro. Castro came way, way, way later. So Polk Street, South of Market, North Beach. There were bathhouses down at the base of Broadway, Dave's Baths, down at the base of Broadway, right down near the Embarcadero. Stuff like that. It was all around. I mean, it was there. There was gay life, for sure. It was a port town.
But on the other hand, it was all closeted this was
early
60s.
Yeah, you'd go into Dave's Baths, and it was, like, really skanky, you know. And they were all, like, really unfriendly at the front desk, and you were kind of lowering your head and going, oh, I'm going to the baths, you know. And it was, like, really nasty in there and whatnot, but it's what you had, you know. So,
did the change occur because of Stonewall, or had the hippies paved the way in San Francisco?
Hippies paved the way, but the hippie culture was not gay-friendly, really. I remember going to one of the be-ins in Golden Gate Park, and there was a little tiny group of gay liberationists who were kind of like now you'd call them the radical fairies. They looked like that. And I thought, my God, those people are so brave. I just couldn't imagine going and joining their little circle. They were just like, you know, the wagons were circled around them. And the hippies were not terribly, as a culture, friendly to gay liberation, though what the hippies did laid the groundwork for all that came after.
People have complained in talking about Bertolucci's The Dreamers that Bertolucci never shows the two guys right. in this threesome getting right. it on, and it occurred to me that given the era, they wouldn't.
Well, they would, but now, for instance, because I lived in a communal setting, and I was kind of like every straight man who wanted to experiment on something gay, he'd come knocking at my door, because I was, for some reason, a safe bet. So they would, and they did, but Bertolucci chose somehow to kind of hint at it, but not really get into it.
Do you think he made a mistake that way?
I don't know. It's Bertolucci's story. He probably wasn't that interested. He probably wasn't knocking at anybody's door, so...
You're listening to an interview with Donald Curry, whose play, Sex and Mayhem, opens tonight at the New Conservatory Theater in San Francisco. Before we move on to the hippie days, I noticed in thinking about this that both the experiences you were having prior to Stonewall, as well as the hippie days, what it was like to actually be a hippie living that life in San Francisco between, say, 65 and 69, 66 and 69. There's very, very little art about either era. You can't really learn too much about them. Maybe it's obvious with the gay stuff, but with the hippie stuff, outside of Petulia, the Richard Lester film, there's virtually nothing, and even that is Hollywood sanitized.
Right. Isn't it interesting? Because to me, when I look back at the history of the 20th century, the 60s, the hippie phenomenon in San Francisco, particularly in other cities as well, but particularly in San Francisco, was seminal. I mean, there was no better time to be a young person in the 20th century. Maybe the 20s, but even that, the 60s was it. And if you were lucky enough to be in your early 20s when the 60s hit in San Francisco, honey, you were having a time.
How did you get involved in the 60s? Was it just when you and your teacher dropped out and moved to a small cabin south of San Francisco?
The 60s swept us all up. If you were willing to be swept up, you couldn't resist it if you were here geographically in San Francisco at that time. Involved in anything creative, maybe you could, but it would be very hard. It was a real tsunami. And certainly the fact that Joseph Demian is his name in the script, and I dropped out, formed a communal theater company, whatnot. We immediately became hooked into the entire communal network, therefore the whole hippie phenomenon.
Where was that?
Well, first we were living in a little cabin in Pacifica, and then we lived in a little house up in Sonoma, and then we were going to move into a bunch of chicken coops that we were going to reconfigure into a home. Thank God we did not, because someone found us a 13-bedroom mansion in Pacific Heights for $1,000 a month, which we sent our most respectable two people in to rent for us, and then we all 25 of us hauled our asses in there, and we lived there for many years, and then Francis Ford Coppola was our landlord for half the time we lived there, and he lowered our rent.
And this was a group called The Fool?
The Gestalt Fool Theater Family, yes.
Did any of these people become well-known?
Yeah, well, John Davis has become a rather well-known director. He's directed a couple of episodes of Oz, and he's pretty... So, yeah, Paul Rebolo, the founder of the company, the co-founder, he and I co-founded it, is quite famous in Europe. He's quite a big personage in Europe, working sort of the growth seminar circuit, but doing psychodrama, week-long, month-long, extraordinary extravaganzas. He's a genius.
I assume from the description in your play, Sex and Mayhem, Donald Curry, I assume that this mansion... On Fillmore Street?
Yeah, Fillmore and Broadway.
Became legendary, did it?
I don't know. It's legendary in my mind, at any rate.
Well, it sounds like you had crazed parties virtually every night.
Oh, absolutely. We had enormously crazed parties. It was 13 bedrooms, two living rooms, an entire ballroom from the length of the house, which was quite a significant length. And we would have many other communes over, and they would just go on all night. They were legendary parties, yes. And all the other communes would come and whatnot, and it was quite a spectacle.
Did any of the famous bands come and perform there?
We had bands perform there. I couldn't say that the Grateful Dead came. We performed with the Grateful Dead at the Fillmore at one point, but they never came to our party and performed. I don't remember who the bands were. We had live rock bands down there, but it beats me who they might have been.
Did you know Bill Graham?
Well, we met him when we did the thing at the Fillmore with the Grateful Dead. Our participation with the Grateful Dead at the Fillmore was to sing I Know Where the Flies Go naked, all 25 of us. It was quite amusing.
What do you mean?
Don't you know that old I Know Where the Flies Go in the Summertime? It's some children's ditty. And we all got up on stage naked and performed it. It was idiotic, but cute.
Was that the only time you performed with the Dead?
Yes.
Did you know... Any of the artists from that era?
Yeah, we did. We knew some of the photographers and whatnot. I can't remember their names. I was, high most of the time. I can't recall a lot. But I know this one guy did this wonderful series of photos that we've called the brothel photos that ended up in Playboy magazine at one point or something. And my friend Blonde Michael, who was a brilliant, just could create these spider webs of gorgeous things, created a sort of whorehouse, and all the women in the commune took their clothes off and did all these brothel poses, and Blonde Michael and I were the pimps. You know, it was very cute.
What was the relationship of the life you were living and the growing anti-war movement?
Oh, very much connected. We would involve ourselves in public things with the Bread and Puppet Theater. We did know the Bread and Puppet Theater people. They were fabulous. Oh, my God, the stuff they did was wonderful. We did a lot of anti-war stuff. We did, we would do like sort of anti-war happenings. Like we'd all get on a morning Muni bus during commute hour, and we'd all sit in different places, and very softly we'd begin singing Give Peace a Chance until the whole bus was singing it. You know, hippie stuff.
The Summer of Love, 66 or 67?
I don't remember which 60, but I remember the Summer of Love.
What was that like? That's
fabulous.
When everybody came to San Francisco.
Heaven. Heaven. Everyone came to San Francisco, and they all converged in Golden Gate Park. They all took the same LSD. It was heaven. Unforgettable. Extraordinary.
You describe at the end of the play how your mentor was kind of carted away. You say it's the end of the 60s, but you're still living in the house. Mm-hmm. The Gestalt Fool is still around.
Mm-hmm.
What happened?
Oh, we continued doing theater even after he was taken away. And then we moved to Marin County, and we lived in a rather large house in Marin County and continued to do theater in San Francisco, but living in Marin County. And then I broke off from the theater part and started writing music and started collaborating with a woman named Pilar, who's still quite a local diva. And she and I had an act called Dawn and Pilar, which we did for about 5 years. And during the course of the time that she and I were doing Dawn and Pilar, the Gestalt Fool essentially stopped being an active theater company. But to this day, I'm still very, very good friends with many of the people from The Fool. And then Dawn and Pilar broke up when I started Western Onion, which was reviving the Singing Telegrams in America. It's my 15 minutes of silly fame, etc.
Western Onion, how did that begin?
That began one night when I was in a bar with a bunch of friends, and we were all high and kind of drunk, and somebody said, I wonder whatever happened to Singing Telegrams. And I looked up, and over the bar was a picture of little Johnny from Philip Morris. And, you know, my kind of stone brain put two and two together. And I thought, and I said out loud, just riffing, oh, I'd love to do a Singing Telegram in a jaunty little bellhop outfit. And a designer friend who was sitting at the table with me said, I'll dare you to do it. Bette Midler's show is opening next Friday night at Berkeley Community. And if you'll go and deliver a Singing Telegram to her, I'll make the outfit. And I said, you're on. It was totally crazy stuff. Then the next Friday night, I got the outfit, the little Johnny Philip Morris outfit, and went and delivered a Singing Telegram to Bette Midler backstage. It was just wonderful. And she just loved it and started passing me along to all the different people backstage. I had to do it over and over and over and over and over again. And then a guy from the Chronicle was there and asked me what had happened and did this interview with me on the spot. And I'm thinking, my God, what's going on? Because I had nothing. I had no intention of seriousness about this. But one thing led to another. And the next Monday morning, Herb Cain had gone away on vacation unannounced, and in place of his column was this long article about me with my picture as Johnny from Philip Morris and my phone number at the bottom of the article. It was insane. Insane.
And then what happened?
No, I never got another night's sleep for 3 years. Because then the article went out on the wires with the phone number, and the phone never stopped ringing. Never. And it was just, this was literally overnight success.
How did you find people in other cities?
We went just, you know, trolling all over the country. And we ended up in, I think, something like 15 cities. We owned the whole floor of a warehouse down south of Market with 800 banks of phones and 800 numbers. It was insane. And we were all just like kind of, you know, recovering hippies at that point.
Were you the president?
I was. My lover and I were the primary owners, and then we had a small group of friends, half of whom came out of the Gestalt Fool. And we got in way over our heads. It blew up in our faces.
When you say that, what do you mean?
We expanded too fast. It's the great mistake of a lot of successful small businesses. They think they're so great that they expand all over the place and then they blow up. And we did too. And that was the beginning of a 7-year nervous breakdown in my life that I almost thought I would never recover from. That's really the beginning of when I stopped doing any performing, any theater, anything like that.
And that was during the crazed 70s then?
That's right. That was my dark night of the soul, from which I thought I would never recover.
Did you recover with the AIDS crisis and you suddenly realized that
yes.
there was work to do?
Yes.
That's what happened?
That snapped me out of it. And that snapped me into Chinese medicine, which really healed me.
So you were basically out of the picture during the height of Harvey Milk and all of that?
I was here. I mean, I went to Japan for a period of time because I was going to move to Japan. But anyway, no, I was here during all of that. No, I was definitely here for this San Francisco in the 70s. That's when it was really heaven.
And then AIDS.
And then AIDS.
And somehow you wound up negative.
Yes. There are miracles in life.
So the beginning of that, friends were suddenly getting sick?
Oh, dying left and right. And dying fast and hard, too. It was just unbelievable. I have entire photo books. I have entire books of photographs of all my friends who were dead. I can't even begin to count. I could probably count my LSD trips easier than I could the people who died.
And how did you get into acupuncture?
It started when I was at the AIDS Foundation, and whenever anyone would call in with questions about alternative medicine, for some reason I was kind of the only one who wouldn't laugh at them. I started talking more and more to people about this kind of stuff, and the actual motivation for it was that one day I had gone to see this acupuncturist myself, this wonderful guy, my lover at the time, who ended up having a sex change and becoming a woman after that, and was one of my most troublesome lovers in the first place. We were sitting in this acupuncturist's office, and he said to me, "This is what you want, isn't it?" It was absolutely a revelation. And I said, "Yes." Because I had a new career every day at that point. That was part of the 7-year nervous breakdown. And I just got up from that office and went to the school where they gave you your master's in it and signed up. Boom, like that. And it was the best choice I could have possibly made. Saved my life.
Do you plan to continue to do the acupuncture if the theater...
Yeah, I guess so. You know, my life is shifting in such a significant way. I don't know what's going to happen next. Because I don't know what's going to happen after this show runs. Where is it going to go next? I think my life is changing in a really serious way. And that may include no longer being an acupuncturist. Maybe time to open the next door.
Do you see yourself performing other people's work?
No, not for a while. What I see myself performing for at least the next 5 years is the fulfillment of this whole saga, and that's going to be my work.
Sex and Mayhem, written and performed by Donald Curry, is at the New Conservatory Theater now through October 10th, maybe extended at that point for a couple of weeks.
Right.
The New Conservatory Theater is located 25 Van Ness near Market. Tickets are available through the box office at 415-861-8972, online at www.nctcsf.org. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.